Ladies and gentlemen, as director of ICAS, I'm very pleased to welcome you to what is the inaugural Distinguished Speaker Series, organized and sponsored by the Institute for International and Comparative Area Studies. This event has benefited from the generous support from the Division of Arts and Science, of Arts and Humanities, the Division of Social Sciences, the Center for the Humanities, the Department of History, and the Program in Chinese Studies. No one today would doubt the growing economic and political importance of China, but understanding this new China, we need also to look backwards and reflect on China's past. So it's entirely fitting that this 2006 Distinguished Lecture Series be entitled The Last Millennium of Chinese History, Transitions from Culture to Nation. And it's our very good fortune to have with us, as our first distinguished scholar, someone who ranks among the finest historians of China in the world. And to introduce Dr. Frederick Wakeman, I'm very pleased to introduce to you my colleague, Joe Eschrich, from the Department of History.
Thank you, Bill. It's a great pleasure to introduce one of the world's great historians of China. PhD of UC Berkeley, before that, Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Harvard, Haas Professor of East Asian Studies at UC Berkeley, former president of the American Historical Association, former president of the Social Science Research Council, a man whose breadth of learning is unmatched in the field, and who in 40 years of teaching at Berkeley has trained a new generation of China scholars who now head PhD programs and history programs in Chinese history at Harvard, Columbia, Berkeley, and a host of other institutions across this country. A pioneer in the 1970s in opening up scholarly exchange with the People's Republic of China, a man who I am honored to call my teacher and proud to call my friend, Frederick Wakeman. If I were to give a detailed accounting of all of Professor Wakeman's accomplishments, it would be 5 o'clock before I finished. But I do want to mention at least a few things. First, as this is a lecture on international comparative and area studies, I think it's worth highlighting some of Professor Wakeman's qualifications in the international studies field. And here I'll just restrict myself to languages. As a young man, he traveled with his family throughout the world and picked up in the process Spanish, French, Italian, and a smattering of Portuguese. He studied European history at Harvard and added German and Russian to his repertoire. It wasn't until he began graduate study in Chinese history that he got around to learning Chinese, and then soon added Japanese to that. After becoming a professor, he didn't stop and decided as he was studying Qing history that learning Manchu was necessary. And there's probably a few other languages in there that I'm not aware of, but this is truly a scholar who is a citizen of our multilingual, multicultural world. Finally, let me briefly introduce some of his major works of scholarship to illustrate the range of his mastery of Chinese history that allows him to speak on a topic as broad as the last millennium of Chinese history. In 1966, just 1 year after receiving his PhD, he published Strangers at the Gate, a social history of the Canton Delta region in the troubled years of the mid-19th century between the Opium War and the Taiping Rebellion. Soon after that, he expanded many of the themes of this history in a textbook entitled The Fall of Imperial China, which is still current enough that I've assigned it to my class this year. From 19th century social history, Wakeman then moved to contemporary intellectual history with History and Will, a study of the philosophical origins of Mao Zedong's thought. And then he moved abruptly back three centuries earlier to the 17th century with The Great Transformation, a magisterial two-volume exploration of the transition from the Ming Dynasty to the Manchu Dynasty of the Qing. About 15 years ago, Wakeman moved back towards the 20th century with a series of books on police and public security in Shanghai, Policing Shanghai, Shanghai Badlands, and the soon-to-appear Red Star over Shanghai. Related to this work was a volume which appeared in 2003 entitled Spy Master, on the Head of the Chinese Nationalist Secret Service, and a fine example of storytelling and history at their best. All of this is but the briefest summary of his writings. If you were to go to the UCSD website, you would find fully 20 titles under his name, and I know very well that that list is not complete. The point of this introduction, however, should be clear. You could not find a person better qualified to give this inaugural ICAS distinguished lecture on the last millennium of Chinese history. I give you Fred Wakeman.
Well, my thanks to Professor Chandler for his invitation and introduction and for giving me the honor to be able to speak to you today in the next 2 days or the next few days of the week. And my special thanks to Joe Eschrick, who was my first student at Berkeley. In fact, along with me, one of the students of the man with whom I'll open this lecture, Joseph Levinson. Joseph Eschrick needs no introduction to any of you, nor to anyone elsewhere in the world who studies modern China seriously. And when he claims me as his teacher, I would have to reverse that and say that most of what I learned about teaching modern Chinese history in the first 2 or 3 years of my career at Berkeley, I owe with some ambivalence to Professor Eschrick. He was a very difficult student. He's mellowed much during these years, but in those years he was a hellion. This first lecture is called The Longue Durée, the long duration, and the Mongol Occupation. More than 50 years ago, the best of China's modern intellectual historians, Joseph R. Levinson, argued that the great political trauma of China at the turn of the 20th century was the transition from culturalism to nationalism. By culturalism, he meant the Chinese elite's self-assurance that its Confucian way, or Dao, of government represented civilization as such, whose values were general and universal principles that should guide enlightened society throughout the underheaven, or tianxia. Modern nationalism, on the other hand, was a concept for which there was no term in Chinese before the late 1800s. The modern Chinese neologism for nationalism, Guojiazhuyi, was historicist and exclusivist. As essentialized Chineseness, it was particular, not universal. It was based upon what we have come to think of as the contemporary markers of national identity, a common language, ethnic origin, and cultural character, shared across an imagined territorial community that was both unique and collectively private. Thus, the price of their adopting a particular national identity was, for many Chinese intellectuals, the loss of a special claim to universality. Or, as Levinson put it then, what was merely mine, meum, replaced what had been universal truth value, verum, in a political cosmology constructed around a China that had traditionally not merely been a civilization among competing ecumens, but claimed to be civilization itself. The demise of universalism, then, was for Levinson the modern fate of Confucian China. Levinson's conceptualization of the transformation from Tianxia, the common underheaven, to Guojia, the exclusive nation state, rested upon a supposedly self-confident culturalism, whose foundations were only shaken by the impact of the West and the rise of the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom in the mid-19th century. I should parenthetically add here that one of Levinson's great contributions was to be able to distinguish between the traditional Chinese notion of an imminent mandate of heaven and a transcendent heavenly mandate, which was the distinguishing characteristic between Confucian monarchy and the Christianic form of Taiping ideology that informed the political legitimacy of the Taiping emperor. The relevance of that to modern times, of course, is that in the Aesopian use of history by Chinese historians after the victory of the People's Republic during the Civil Wars, the character that was most thought to represent the figure of Mao Zedong in modern history was the figure of Hung Xiuquan, the Chinese Taiping Emperor. This is the man also that Professor Jonathan Spence has written about in his book on God's Chinese Son. What I would like to do now is to call that self-confident culturalism into question by going back in time to the high cultural glory of the Northern and Southern Song. Again, parenthetically, the totality of Levinson's thought was deeply conditioned by his own teacher at Harvard, John King Fairbank, who also was a teacher of Joe Eschrich, and who very much emphasized the impact of the West on Chinese thought and learning. The impact and response school of historiography that Fairbank sponsored and that more or less bore his name imagined a kind of whole and unshattered culture that was still at least complacently self-confident by the early part of the 19th century. Hence, the coming of the West in its most aggressive form during the Opium Wars of the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, 60s was a shock that only at that point, began to destroy this confidence. What I'm trying to suggest here, and we'll analyze in today's lecture and in a bit of Wednesday's lecture, is the argument, or what I shall try to present, is the argument that this culturalism was not complacent. It was by no means as full of self-confidence and optimism about the universal qualities of Chinese kingship or the Chinese civilization itself. Rather, what I think we see in the history of China since the Song are a series of disruptions or caesura marked by foreign conquests, first the Mongols and then the Manchus in the 17th century, that not only broke down the continuity of Chinese history, but also seriously undermined that self-confidence. But as is so often the case with ideologies, which usually are systems of thought that grow up between the discrepancy of what really is and what men and women wish things could be, is that the appearance of complacency was steadfastly maintained. while underneath the surface, hard at first to discern, we realized that the complacency was only that, only a superficial covering of what had to be much more uncertain foundations about the nature of the Chinese state system and of Chinese culture as such. The prevailing Western view of the Song is of a period of sophisticated institutional stabilization, of widespread commercial urbanization, of stunning artistic accomplishment, and of unprecedented intellectual synthesis. The latter has commanded the most attention because of the connections between the learning of the way, Daoxue, or what is also sometimes called the school of principle or mind, Li Xue, and the emergence of state orthodoxy during the late imperial period of the Ming and Qing dynasties, that is, the 14th to 19th centuries. When the leading Song philosophers, Zhou Dunyi, Zhang Zai, the brothers Cheng Yi and Cheng Hao, and Zhu Xi, together and in succession, constructed the monumental edifice of what we now call Neo-Confucianism, they little imagined that their dualistic metaphysics, together with their canonical commentaries, would come to dominate the formation of generations of future literati through the state examination system that persisted until 1905. As Peter Bowl recently put it, and I quote, "Neo-Confucianism was one of the central threads of intellectual and cultural continuity between the Song, Yuan, and Ming periods. When the teachings, conceptions, and core texts of the great Neo-Confucian scholars entered the examination curriculum in the late Southern Song and became required reading in Yuan and Ming, Neo-Confucianism became a necessary part of the shared culture of the literati, or shi." In Bowles' rendition, culture is continuity, and tradition is more an extended transition, a longue durée rather than a concatenation of connections and caesura. In sum, and again, I'm parenthetically inserting this, the position taken by Professor Bowl and many of his epigonen is that Chinese culture, the high culture of the intellectual class, the gentry, scholar, officials, literati, call them what you may, the shi or shi daifu, was the main constituent of this long stream of continuity from the 10th century down unto the, really unto the 19th century. And that it was never really sharply interrupted. He writes in another context of this China of ours, this sense of a common Chinese culture that seems to move along unperturbed, basically undisturbed by cultural shocks coming from the outside. Bowles's cultural conservatism, and now I'm going to get into it. Peter Bowl is not a man one easily takes on, and I'm going to get in very serious difficulty for this with Peter, who not only doesn't always forgive, but he doesn't forget for sure. Bowles's cultural conservatism is, I don't know why I'm willing to take him on at my age, but in any case, there's a joke that's making the rounds now. Well, I don't know if it's making the rounds, but it's certainly a joke that I heard from a friend who lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Bowles teaches. Recently, Bowles and the Harvard faculty tried to entice a very famous Song social scholar from Columbia to Harvard. Professor Bowl was convinced that the hook was well baited, that the hook had been set, and that they were going to get this person, or so he told me with great conservative confidence. And in the end, the fellow didn't go. The scholar, whose Robert Himes, Professor Himes of Columbia, decided to stay in New York, where he was perfectly happy. A few months later, I was talking to a German friend who lives in Cambridge. I was in Berlin last term, and he came to see me, and I said, you know, I haven't had a chance yet to read Bob Himes' recent work on Taoism. I'm really eager to get a hold of that. Have you read that yet? And with a completely flat face, a expressionless face, my friend Professor Saxemeyer said, well, no, you know, it's impossible to get a copy of Himes' book in Cambridge, Massachusetts these days. I said, really? Why is that? He said, well, Peter Bowles has gone around and bought them all up and burned them. So I'm fearful that whatever books of mine are in Widener won't be in Widener after this speech is published. Bowles is cult, and I won't speak of the other people. I met Richard von Glahn, about whom I'll speak in a minute, at the recent Association for Asian Studies meeting, and told him I was eager, if I could put it that way, for him to read this essay. And he looked both alarmed and gleeful, as if, now that you're moving on to my tour, if you wait and see. Bowles's cultural conservatism is shared by a number of other scholars eminent in Sung studies in the United States. One of the most articulate and persuasive of these evolutionists is the historian Paul Yakov Smith, who, together with Richard von Glahn, seeks to fill the what they call historiographical black hole between Tang Song and Ming Qing by inventing a distinct historical epic, which they call the Song Yuan Ming transition. By Song, Smith here really means the Southern Song, which permits him to place the Jurchen Jin Dynasty, these are Northeast Asians from outside the Great Wall, that conquered North China in 1127, alongside the Chinese regime that fled south after the fall of Kaifeng and that established itself in Hangzhou in 1132. Both were together the starting point of the long transition to come. In other words, if you're dealing only with the Southern Song, which occupied the southern half of the country, or of the zone we think of as China, and the Jin, who occupied the northern half, then you have a common starting point that breaks down the distinction between barbarian and Han, or native dynasties, into a single inception of the transition. Both were together the starting point of the long transition to come. Clumping the two together also makes it possible for the evolutionists to sidestep the issue of the erosion of universal cultural confidence during the rise of other states. And I mentioned here the Tangut Shixia, which is a Tibetan, we think Tibetan, but Sino-Tibetan speaking group in what is now Western China, the Khitan Liao, and the Dali regime down in the southwest, when the Northern Song was merely, as Professor Rosabi puts it, one among equals. In other words, what we really have here is a multi-state system in which China, though claiming pride of place as civilization, the central kingdom, et cetera, you know, Tian Shao, the heavenly dynasty, is actually one among a number of states that are competing for supremacy in Asia at this time, which forces the Chinese to come to a certain different appreciation of their place in the world. Now, if I can again make a digressive parenthetical aside, in China, if you examine the history of Chinese foreign relations, or if you read the documents of Chinese foreign relations, you quickly discover that there are two different audiences, at least, for official imperial edicts concerning relations with other countries or states or statelets in Asia. In the ideal Chinese world order, the emperor is the son of heaven in this kind of pyramidal structure, And lesser states are vassals, owing suzerainty to the Son of Heaven. The suzerainty or vassalhood is expressed not so much in feudalistic terms as in familistic terms. The Chinese emperor is the elder brother, younger brother, and so on. And along and the states, whether they be Korea or Annam or Japan, which was not easily coaxed into this orbit. At one time, one of its rulers admitted or accepted the system and was promptly denounced by his ministers, and the Japanese did not fit easily into this. But the point is that in communicating with foreign states or foreign representatives directly, the Chinese state, particularly in the Ming, as we shall see, had the habit of saying one thing to the outsider and another thing to the court inside the country. Probably the most salient example of this was occurred in the early 15th century when Timur the Lame, Tamerlane, how does Marlowe put it, the scourge and terror of the known world, thinking of conquering China. Sort of had it on his mind. Of course, his empire was located in the reign of the in the area of the old Ilkhanate Mongols, and received an edict from the Ming Emperor addressing him in this Chinese world order terminology, dear younger brother, blah 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 blah, you know, with the Chinese Emperor's name elevated two characters above the line, and all of the ritual and protocol that singled out China as being eminent. And Tamerlane was furious. He said, you know, more or less, I don't know Mongol very well, so I won't try to give you the Mongol. Son of a bitch, who does he think he is? What does he get off? It's about time for me to move in there and teach him a lesson or two. And he was in the process, in fact, of mounting a campaign to invade China, which would have been very, very hard on the Ming dynasty, needless to say, when he sickened and died of other causes. But in communicating with his son, Sharif, who inherited the Mongol Khanate from his father, Tamerlane, the Ming emperors, knowing of this, began to send correspondents to Samarkand and Herat, where this particular late Mongol dynasty was located, which treated them completely as equals. In other words, they dropped all of the pretenses of this familistic hierarchy in which the Chinese state was the highest on the ladder, and began to discuss things in a more multi-sided fashion. But the documentation at court, that is the edicts that were revealed to the court ministers and that were put into the veritable records and so on for the dynasty to leave as a historical record for the compilation of their own dynastic history by their successors, presented the old imperial world historical order fully intact. So the point is, you have a domestic audience which is led to believe we're still Tian Chao, we walk above all others, and in fact, at times, under the obvious duress of state interest and superior military force, the Chinese, in fact, were quite realistic in recognizing the impossibility of acting that way towards potential enemies. There's always a certain disconnect, then, in Chinese foreign relations during the late imperial period. And it comes to the fore during periods of great crisis when the dynasty may feel obliged to negotiate with a would-be invader, an enemy, on equal terms, but dare not announce that openly within the court or for a domestic audience, because it would run athwart the pretensions of universal supremacy that the Chinese world order conveyed to its subjects. A very good example of this was in 1642 when the Chungcheong Emperor, the last Ming Emperor in Peking, decided that he would like to have some kind of division of spoils between his own dynasty, which was faltering and failing, and the rising Manchu dynasty in the Northeast, and initiated secret negotiations through one of his ministers. In those days, the equivalent of the modern press was the Peking Gazette, which was more like the Congressional Record, I suppose. And office clerks had a steady source of income in copying documents off of their bosses' desks and selling them to the Peking Gazette publishers, who would then publish them in this record of matters of state, which circulated in the capital and in the provinces where retired or otherwise in mourning officials might read them. This guy, the minister who was in charge of these top secret negotiations, saw the document that was this about this intercourse between Ming China and the Manchus, and unwittingly, or perhaps he didn't know what he was doing, but in any case, with great risk, sold it to the publishers. And when it appeared, of course, there was a tremendous outbreak at court, with the young Han officials, especially young censors, decrying this appeasement, this sellout. In other words, it brought all of the war hawks into the room to accuse or to want to have a scapegoat for this glaring evidence of the disconnect that I mentioned earlier. As a result, the emperor had to pretend he knew nothing about it. The minister whom he had delegated to do this was like the police chief in Machiavelli's Prince. He was sacrificed to the crowd, accused of high treason, and killed by slicing, so as to maintain the fiction of there being no discrepancy at all between what the Chinese told themselves. Now, I don't want to get too cynical about this. And it may reflect my years of dealing with a certain Sinocentrism, but nonetheless, the historical record at least bears me out in this regard. What I'm arguing here, though, is that as one among equals, the rise of these barbarian dynasties, the establishment of barbarian dynasties in what had been the northern and western reaches of the Tang Empire, that is between 618 and 906 AD, directly challenged the Sung literati's belief that the heavenly mandate, the Tianming, was bestowed upon a Chinese emperor whose moral rule had unified Tongyi, the underheaven. Confucian Ru, that is, Confucian scholars, could console themselves with the thought that even though the underheaven was now shared with non-Chinese peoples, they themselves continued to be the bearers of universal culture. They could even adopt a kind of proto-nationalism based upon hyper-patriotism and territorial irredentism, or more specifically, the hero that every Chinese school kid knows of, UFA, and the evil minister Qin Gui, and so on, and UFA's mission to recover North China from alien rule. But this form of particularistic proto-nationalism, which is narrowly defined as, and here the definition is from Nicola di Cosimo of Princeton, those who possessed Chinese surnames and who shared in a national descent group patrimony stemming from the mythical Yellow Emperor, unquote, was stunted by pretensions of universality, pretensions in turn strongly shaken by barbarian invasion and rule. What I'm suggesting here is that if you live too long with what Mannheim called a cant mentality, that is where there is a certain degree of cognitive dissonance between what you want to believe and what exists, universality that you think you believe in is stunted. It doesn't grow. It doesn't pursue a vigorous life of its own. It's frozen. It's lithified. Now, the greatest historical tumbler, the greatest shock of all in this question of dealing with other equal states, was set off by the juggernaut of the Mongol conquest. And here I'm giving you a quote as well. Quote, the Mongols, this is a kind of, how can I put it, somewhat old-fashioned. Well, not really. This thing was written in the late 90s, but it's a kind of old-fashioned view of the Mongol menace and what the Mongols did. Still, I think it's worth listening to because, in general, it represents a certain consensus. The Mongols represent the culmination of a millennia-long preoccupation of the sedentary world with the barbarians of the Eurasian steppe. It's a little hyperbolic. An early expression of which is the story of Gog and Magog in the Old Testament. But it is not only that the Mongols were more successful than any of their inner Asian predecessors in erecting a tribally based state and thereupon siphoning off the surplus of the surrounding sedentary states. They had set about conquering the then known world, creating the largest land empire in history, which lasted, albeit in attenuated form, for some 150 years, and in certain areas even longer. The conquest itself was effected with great fanfare, although contemporaries were horrified, justly so, by the extent of the destruction and killing. The result, not always appreciated by the majority of those, this is the quote continuing, who became their subjects, was the opening up of Asia from east to west and back again, creating such opportunities for cultural exchange and interaction. Rulers such as Genghis Khan, Kublai, Hulagu, Ghazan, and Uzbek, as well as Tamerlane and Babur, are the stuff of which legend and literature are made. Ably assisted, and this really is hyperbolic, by the medieval equivalent, at least it's ahistorical, ably assisted by the medieval equivalent of public relations consultants, such as Marco Polo and Rashid al-Din, the Mongols have remained on center stage in the human imagination for hundreds of years. According to many writers, Adil of the Hun was the scourge of God, of course. Tamerlane was, as I mentioned, the terror of the known world. The appearance of steppe pastoral peoples from their emergent history until the mid-17th century never changed. They remained cruel, devastating events. Their relevance to world history was seemingly limited to their more or less ruinous impact on the development of neighboring civilizations, China, India, Islam, and Christianity. To traditional Chinese historians, the Mongol period was also a time of shuwaijishi, history outside of history. Because of the Mongol division of its Yuan dynasty subjects into a descending hierarchy of Mongols, Simu, which mainly refers to Central and Western Asian peoples, Hanren, a Han people, but that mainly refers to former subjects of the Jin dynasty from the north, and Nanren, southerners. Chinese literati have viewed the period from 1278 to 1368 as a disastrous and uprooting century that brought not only economic exploitation and suffering to the Chinese people, but a drastic interruption to Chinese culture and civilization as well. They sensed correctly that the Mongols intentionally used terror and violence both to subjugate sedentary populations and to maintain the autocracy of their Khan, who had to continue to enrich and engage his subjects by continuing war. To be sure, the Mongol military practice of wholesale massacre was somewhat alleviated after the Sumu minister Yelu Chuzai persuaded Genghis Khan's son and heir, Ögedei, that it was more profitable to tax subjects than to annihilate them. This is a famous scene where Yelu Chuzai says, you don't want to go. Ögedei was thinking about, well, maybe if we just kill all the peasants in North China and turn their fields into grazing lands for our herds, that would be the best disposition of this new territory we've been trying to take over. And Yelu Chuzai says, no, my sovereign, that's not a good idea. Actually, if you think about it a little bit, if you tax these people, then you might be able to get a greater income and more of a return on your investment in your own men, weapons, and steeds. And to some people's surprise, the emperor agreed. It certainly was true that by the time of Mongke's reign, 1251 to 1259, the Mongols in China banned the indiscriminate killing of Chinese agricultural taxpayers for being fiscally counterproductive, but murder, plunder, and terror, as exemplified in the destruction of Baghdad in 1258, were still acceptable political tools as long as the Khan decreed their use. In other words, Mongke insisted that the Khan himself had to permit his men to go in and, as they said at Herat, sheathe your swords after the streets are running blood, red with blood. He had to be able to permit such massacre rather than just to let it happen, as had been the case before during the great expansive period of the Mongol conquest. Nevertheless, even though this order was there, Kublai Khan, who reigned from 1260 to 1294 in China, had to repeat the order not to slaughter haphazardly during the siege of Xiangyang in 1273, even though the Mongols' ongoing conquest of China had already laid the foundation for a direct taxation empire by creating a sophisticated and elaborate central and regional bureaucracy. Now, again, very, very quickly and parenthetically, I don't want to leave the impression that we're dealing with a bunch of Hell's Angels who've taken over San Diego. I mean, it's true that the early Mongol Khan were illiterate. That's not true for the later rulers. By the late Yuan Dynasty, which was the Mongol Dynasty, which only ruled really for really about a century, the Mongol emperors were relatively sophisticated, and they had, above all, learned how to move from being a raiding dynasty, a steppe dynasty, based on loot, to tribute, and finally to taxation, all of which indicated their evolution towards a more settled form of government. The Manchus occupied Hangzhou in February 1276. The Yuan forces took another 3 years to wipe out southern Song remnants in the southeastern provinces. One of the consequences of this loyalist resistance was a deep Mongol distrust of the south and its inhabitants. As we have seen, southerners, Nanren, were politically stigmatized by being placed at the very bottom of the four-tiered social order. They were punished more severely in the Yuan Law Code. They took more difficult examinations under a discriminatory quota once the civil service system was reintroduced in 1315. And even as clerical officials, they had to converse in the official language of the empire, which was Mongol. I say as clerical officials because the highest offices in the Yuan government were monopolized by the other three groups of Mongols, Sumu, and Hanren. The Nanren were only given subordinate positions in the local bureaucracy, serving as instructors in public schools and academies, or as clerks in the local yamen, the office, of a multi-tiered government. What was unusual about the Yuan was the sheer number of territorial administrative units in regional local government, whereas previous dynasties used a two- or three-level system of submetropolitan administration. The Yuan, at its most complex, employed an unprecedented system in descending order: regional secretariats, circuits, routes, prefectures, subprefectures, and counties. In other words, six tiers. Because the Mongols appointed Mongol or Sumu, the Central or West Asians, as Dartachi, or in Chinese, Dalu Huachi, that is, officials who duplicated or supervised native Chinese at all six levels of submetropolitan government, except for regional secretariats, the Yuan administration was much larger than that of other imperial dynasties. By the early 1300s, the regular bureaucracy numbered more than 27,000 officials. Now, the evolutionists, the cultural continuity people, present clerical service not as demeaning for the southern literati, but as one of the most reliable routes into a regular bureaucratic position under the Mongols, which enabled them to reach an unprecedented level of status and professionalization. This is their wording. They thus downgrade the Southern Sung resistance innate sense of culture and ethnicity, and assert that even, and this is another name that nationalist and communist school texts wave, you know, as we wave the Alamo or something like that. They assert that even Wen Tianxiang's troops were composed of unreliable She aborigines and local bandits whose defection led in the end to the loyalist paragon's suicide in coastal Guangzhou. Guangzhou then is what we now call Guangdong. The people's heroic support of the Sung cause, this again is the evolutionists, presented in local traditions and folklore as history, thus turns out to be closer to myth. That's a quote, direct quote from Mr. Smith, Professor Smith. The evolutionists also emphasize the benefits of the Yuan conquest to local landlord engrossment in South China, which quickened Sung trends towards concentrated landholding, parcelized cultivation, and increased tenancy rates. Yuan fiscal policy permitted rich families to evade labor service, which was foisted off on poorer peasants who commended their land to southern elites and fell into servitude. Yuan landlords amassed more and more land, which they rented out in ever smaller plots to increasing numbers of tenants. Moreover, Yuan rule enjoyed a brief period of prosperity before the civil wars of the mid-14th century. As Paul Yakov Smith argues, over the long term, the Mongol conquest of the Southern Sung was less destructive to members of the local South Chinese elite than was the failure of the Yuan regime to establish strong and durable institutions of a dynastic rule. In other words, we have the conquest and the southern resistance, but that wasn't nearly as bad as the Yuan in its latter years, its last years, after the mid-14th century, when terrible strife broke out in China, and of course, the entire world suffered from the bubonic plague. For not long after the elite survivors of the Sino-Mongol Wars had returned, I love this, the elite survivors of the Sino-Mongol Wars. Jesus. I see these people coming back. You read descriptions of the highways in those days filled with refugees. And well, anyway, we historians have ways of doing this to and for ourselves, I suppose. Not long after the elite survivors of the Sino-Mongol Wars had returned to a comfortable prosperity under Yuan rule, their children were buffeted by the instability and civil wars that engulfed Yuan society from the late 1330s to the collapse of the dynasty in 1368. Yet Smith also acknowledges that there may have been racial animosity at more plebeian levels of society. While their Mongol rulers were worried about commoners and kept the Chinese from carrying weapons, the latter, that is the Chinese, showed traces of a latent xenophobia, especially in the south. Even during the first decade of the 14th century, disorder prevailed in the countryside. Brigands preyed upon merchants and travelers in Jiangxi, Fujian, and Guangzhou. Urban gangs extorted money from passers-by. Robberies and murders spread beyond South China to the capital. Pirates infested the Yangtze River and fought gang wars among themselves. Jiangnan is the area of the Yangtze Delta. Jiangnan collaborators known as cat's heads, Maotou, or door guards, Dingmen, plied their Mongol overseers with wine, women, song, and jewelry, and feigned friendship with them to gain influence. Their masters in turn, that is the Mongols, sold offices to this rabble. In exchange for bribes, 7 or 8 of every 10 local posts were given to wine peddlers and butchers, grain brokers and marketplace riffraff, who raped local women, commandeered property, and rigged district law cases in their favor. There were many celebrated instances of sociopathic brutality as well, rampant cannibalism, the evisceration of pregnant women, and wanton carnage. The psychic weight of crime and violence suffused Yuan society. There were natural disasters too, of course. Historians have accounted for 513 disasters of national significance during the 100 years of Mongol rule. 92 floods, 86 droughts. I could go on to enumerate these disasters, but I won't, except to mention the 20 epidemics. The latter took an especially devastating toll. Long-distance trade under the Mongols facilitated the spread of bubonic plague. McNeil and others believe, in fact, that the Mongol horsemen's disturbance of the burrows of rodents, such as we would call them, I guess, ground chucks, along the Gobi Desert, the sides of the Gobi Desert, led to their emergence from their rodent, from their lairs, and their intermixing with Norwegian rats that had migrated across Asia, thus creating the exchange of, or permitting the exchange of lice that carried the bubonic bacillus that made its way back via India to Europe. As a result, between 1200 and 1400, the year is 1200 and 1400 CE, China's population declined from 115 to 70 million. This secular calamity did not go unobserved, but contemporaries such as Wang Wei, who lived in the 14th century, also lamented the harmful impact of the Mongol conquest upon Chinese culture. This is Wang Wei's quote. After the Yuan conquest of Jiangnan, the customs of ritual and culture, Li Wen, changed under the influence of the overbearing crudity of the conquerors, such that after a few decades, everyone became so acclimated to it that it became custom, and the old ways of the Song completely disappeared. The Shi, that is the scholars, plaited their hair. You know, the barbarians of northern and western China wore their hair in braids and queues, and wore short coats, riding coats. They weren't hampered by long scholars' gowns that might prevent them from drawing their weapons. They mimicked the Mongol language, they pretended they spoke Mongol, and dress in order to ingratiate themselves with their rulers in the hope that they might thereby advance themselves. Those who steadfastly clung to Chinese tradition were ridiculed for being backward and shy. This era was, in the words of another 14th century contemporary, Jin Ri Luan Shi, this age of chaos. I have no argument with Nicolas de Cosmo's basic assertion that all four alien dynasties, the Liao, the Xixia, the Jin, and the Yuan, were similar not because of their foreignness, but because they were the product of the gradual and by no means linear formation of a political society proper to the Great Walled Zone and a large portion of northern China. This society was multi-ethnic, multicultural, multilingual, militarily dominated by non-Chinese, and played a paramount role in Chinese history from the fall of the Han to 1911. But I do contend that evolutionists have exaggerated the continuity from Song to Ming, and that the fall of the Yuan in the mid-14th century constituted a watershed in Chinese history. Furthermore, the period of Mongol rule itself was a trauma that shook the confidence of Confucian Universalists and stirred Chinese particularists in many ways that foreshadowed the 17th century tremor yet to come, which will be partly the topic of Wednesday's lecture. Thank you.
Well, Professor Wegman, thank you so much for this enlightening presentation. I was not so aware of the violence and chaos in this period, I must say. So thank you very much, and we are looking forward to the next two lectures in the rest of this week. So thank you once again for